Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Barbra Streisand. So, Mike, to start off with, how does a nice Jewish girl from Brooklyn become Barbra Streisand, mega superstar, not just of movies, but music and pretty much everything she put her hand to, whether it was the stage, recording music, starring in films, directing films? Where do we start with this huge megastar?
She is one of the ultimate multiple hyphenate movie stars. I mean, you know, we're talking about film, so, you know, but multi-hyphenate talent. I mean, for us as a movie star, but as a recording artist, musical theater on Broadway and so on, you know, in terms of her political and philanthropic concerns, I mean, she's just everywhere with it. But what's significant, Marie, and you've already kind of indicated this in our introduction, is that she is always, and has always remained, that nice Jewish girl from Brooklyn. When she's periodically returned to the concert stage, like, you know, a facility in Brooklyn or, you know, anywhere in New York City, she always goes back to childhood. She always mentions things like that. And it's all melting like butter for the audience. I mean, they're all just real, they're just really eating it up. And I'm being facetious here, but she really, that meant so much to her, that kind of ethnicity there that so many people could relate to. You know, when you look at Hollywood movie stars, most of them have in one way or another become assimilated. In other words, you become a movie star, right? And whatever your ethnic extraction was kind of gets sublimated. I mean, this is a generalization, but certainly in the studio era, and I would argue to the present day, the tendency is you just become a big movie star. But in her case, there was always the sense of this was the nice Jewish girl from Brooklyn. And one, because that's her personality, that's the whole persona, how she presents herself, whether in concert or you know, in a movie role. But specifically, a lot of the film roles, of course, would overtly play off of that in a way. And so it's there. You know, we'll talk about Funny Girl and things like that, but it's right there. But in terms of quite literally how she did get in, from her generation, she's born in 1942. By the 1950s, she's appearing, you know, in Greenwich Village nightclubs. And, you know, she's kind of, you know, paying her dues as a performer. And she's making a name for herself off Broadway, things like that. Her real breakthrough is quite dramatic, though. I mean, so she put in a few years of paying the dues, but her Broadway debut in 1962 was in I Can Get It For You Wholesale. She plays Miss Marmalstein there. For Broadway showbiz buffs, that's a musical that's well remembered. It did extremely well when it came out. She was a name, in other words. She was just so distinctive right from the get-go. Now, that's us talking about her at the moment on the Broadway stage. She's also in the recording studio at that time. In 1963, she releases her first album. It wins 2 Grammy Awards. So she's been on Broadway, and now she's gotten 2 Grammy Awards for her first album. And right on the heels of that, segueing into 1964, she has her really, really big breakthrough. And she's been breaking through for a few years now, but this is it right now. She appears as Fanny Brice in Funny Girl. Now, if you look at Broadway musical theater in the 1960s, it is one of the iconic moments there. It absolutely, you know, gets her launched on the national stage, to put it that way. And speaking of that kind of national recognition and beyond, as you get into the mid-1960s, as you know, she's doing a lot of her recordings and she's, you know, had and still has that great voice. She's known for that as well in the recording studio and concert stage, but she's also doing a lot of TV specials. This is something that marks her in a generational way. Some of the older stars would have, you know, been on talk shows or this or that, but an important part of her career at this point is doing TV specials. One of them wins an Emmy in 1965. So think about it this way. By the mid-1960s, she's been picking up Grammy Awards and Emmy Awards and all this recognition, and she's becoming a figure who is distinctly and proudly Jewish. In fact, at that time, we're going back to mid-60s, Vogue described her as, quote, a whole new taste in beauty. Now, you know, that's the Vogue way of putting it, but a whole new taste in beauty. In other words, she doesn't fit the conventional designations of beauty for, which has to do with, you know, an Americanized star. You know, let me give an example of how that played out in pop culture. Obviously, there's no escaping the nose, if you will. And so, you know, other actresses who had a prominent schnoz would get the plastic surgery or something, not Streisand. In fact, there's a famous quip, you know, think about Funny Girl, where she's playing Fanny Brice. you know, a very Jewish stage star. And when I say very Jewish, I mean it's the ethnic material that gets worked into the songs, into the comedy routines. It's right there. It's the whole shebang right there. There's a famous crack where Dorothy Parker said, you know, Fanny Brice did actually have some cosmetic surgery. And then Parker wrote that Fanny Brice cut off her nose to spite her race. I know, it's one of the great Dorothy Parker quotes. And the thing is, when Barbara Streisand played Fanny Brice, who'd had the nose job, if you will, she made a point of not downplaying or in any way through plastic surgery, changing all that. And that's so important for us to talk about, the ways in which Streisand really changed her identity. No, she didn't change her identity. I'm getting so wrapped up in this. She really wanted people to accept her on her own terms. And sometimes people would take pot shots at her. Let me give some, you know, we should probably not say mean things, so we'll say them anyway, because people did say some mean things about her along the way there. Just as, you know, Dorothy Parker had that, you know, immortal quote about Fanny Brice. Once you've heard that quote, you'll always think of it when you think of Fanny Brice. But when Barbara Streisand was becoming a star and adamantly deciding not to change her image, not to change her nose, if you will, the symbolism of that nose. In the early 1960s, Variety, which was reviewing her on Broadway and in the recording studio, et cetera, you know, Variety was writing about her. And in one of the early Variety reviews, they noted that she needed, quote, a schnoz bob, close quote. I mean, this is what was being said about her. I have to put quotation marks around a lot of this so nobody thinks I'm saying it, but Variety said that about her. And another thing that definitely needs quotes around it, so you don't think it's me saying it, the notoriously mean-spirited critic, John Simon, who was always making fun of actors for their appearance. I mean, we could do a show just on all the nasty things he said about people, how they looked, right? I mean, he was no great shakes to look at either, but the nasty things he said about people for how they looked on screen. But John Simon actually wrote at some length about Barbara Streisand's nose. Only John Simon maybe would do this. And he said that her nose, quote, towers like a ziggurat made of meat, close quote. You can't get much nastier than that. And yet what's significant for me is that she had things like that as her proud trademark and her whole identity being built around being the nice Jewish girl from Brooklyn. Yes, it's a big nose, get used to it. You know, it's a whole new taste in beauty, as Vogue would say. If you're really interested in this subject, because it really segues into issues of cultural identity, you know, not to be, you know, so obsessed with assimilation, have to look like everyone else or some ideal generically. No, she's a Jewish girl and that's what she's gonna play. Neil Gabler, who's a really good cultural historian, film historian, wrote a book in 2016 called Barbara Streisand, Redefining Beauty, Femininity, and Power. And in that book, he deals with everything I've just been mentioning, all the things that were said about Streisand, not always positive, people making fun of her, if you will, but you know, certainly they couldn't deny her talent. And you know, she not only survived, but triumphed. But one thing that Gabler says in the book that's really, I think, revelatory in terms of how Streisand proudly held her own in this respect, Gabler writes that, you know, by her middle years, you know, in the early years, people take pot shots. In later years, you don't see comments like that nearly as often, do you? It's not just that we're more sensitive to it. It's just that, you know, she's overcome all that, right? Those were like early career notices. So Gabler writes that by the time she's well established, quote, she had become so much a part of our consciousness that we accepted her for who she was. The assimilation was not hers, it was ours.
We'd like a new taste of beauty, I guess. You know, interestingly, it seems like a lot of people who go on to great things seem to have been destined for greatness because they rub shoulders with other people who go on to great things. So I wanted to mention that when she went to Erasmus High School, she had an unrequited crush on a schoolmate who would become chess genius Bobby Fischer. She also was in the choir with Neil Diamond long before they did that duet with You Don't Bring Me Flowers. And she was in the same acting school with Dustin Hoffman when she was 16, 17 years old. She says that she used to babysit to get free acting lessons and he was the janitor. So, you know, she certainly met a lot of people before anybody was the big stars that they would later go on to be. In terms of the nose job thing, I did, while you were talking, I was thinking that I remember the 1970s being a time when that was really the thing to do, that a lot of people went and had their nose done. and it was very popular. So the fact that she resisted that, it wasn't just that, you know, they try to make everybody over. It was also just incredibly fashionable at the time. So she really held out, I think, to make sure that she didn't take a chance with losing that voice, because you just never know what can happen when you do that. So let's get into talking about Funny Girl, because she bursts into the movie scene with that movie, bowls everybody over with how great she is in it, and then wins the Academy Award first time out of the gate. And what a performance. Nobody else could own that role the way she does. I mean, it really is her role. But apparently she was, speaking of the criticism that has been leveled her way, insufferable to work with. Director William Wyler was asked by a friend whether Streisand had been hard to work with, and he replied, no, not too hard, considering it was the first movie she ever directed. So I think she had a presence and knew who she was and what she was going to try to do with her career. And don't anybody get in her way. But, you know, in a way, I think she was on to something.
Well, when you think about Funny Girl, as we mentioned earlier, that was her, you know, big Broadway role in 64. She makes her screen debut in 1968 with the film version of it. And not only is it like, you know, a great way to make your first movie, but she wins the Academy Award. Now, an interesting footnote in Oscar history is she actually shares the award. It's a tie between Katharine Hepburn in The Lion in Winter and Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl. The only time that's ever happened in the Best Actress category. It's happened once before for Best Actor, but the fact that they share the award that way, but an indication of how, you know, she has won over, you know, the critics certainly and the Academy Award voters, and it's an iconic role, because when she's playing Fanny Bryce, that takes us back to the early 20th century in showbiz history. But to have a distinctly Jewish performer who's, you know, a major American star of the stage, you know, everything Fanny Bryce represented, here's Streisand coming along decades later, playing that character on Broadway and now in a movie. And as Marie indicated, it's one of those performances where you couldn't pick a more perfect role for her. You know, I mean, it's ideal that way. And she knew exactly how to play it. And this is one area where, you know, people will talk about how difficult she is in this and that, but think about it. This is her material. She knows this character. And William Wyler was no slouch in terms of her reputation as a great film director, but who's going to direct her? And I think ultimately, just to jump ahead for a moment, it indicates that it won't be too many years hence before Barbara Streisand's directing her own movies, right? She's directing and producing and co-scripting and this and that and doing the music. And, you know, if you enter into a Streisand production, it's hers. And so she will be one of those really powerful performers who in some ways is not taking direction from others or doesn't take it well. So I love the quote you gave from William Wyler, because she really is kind of just going her own way. But when you see the results, when it works, right? You know, and I think a smart director would know at a certain point, just stand back and let her do what she does. Or in any event, you can't stop her, so you might as well let her go.
That's totally how that's going to happen, whether you like it or not. Her niece saw Funny Girl and asked her, how come you're singing so many songs from Glee? That's what happens when you get that famous. You actually, people don't even understand that you were the one who made it big. So I want to ask you about your first Barbara sighting, what movie it was that put her on the map for you, Mike. I had heard about her, of course, from her music, but the first movie I saw with Barbara Streisand in it would be 1973, The Way We Were. And this, of course, is a tearjerker of the nth degree that she appears in with Robert Redford. And it's directed by Sidney Pollack. And it's written by Arthur Lawrence, who actually wrote it about his own life, about his lifelong romance with Farley Granger, who you may remember from some of Hitchcock's movies. So it has sort of the imprimatur of being a true story, while at the same time being a very, very melodramatic love story. And it's a five hanky affair. If you watch it, by the way, if you watched it in the pre-widescreen and high-def TV days, some of the showings would show the scenes during the opening credits squeezed into the screen, and everybody looked unnaturally tall and thin. But my reaction to watching this movie was just that was the most romantic movie ever made. Just worked on me in some elemental level. How about you, Mike? What was your first Barbara movie and what did you think of The Way We Were?
Well, I'd seen Funny Girl when it first came out in 1968, and I've seen really everything of hers as it came out since then. She follows up by doing the screen adaptation of Hello, Dolly in 1969, not a very good screen version of a big hit that works really well on stage, and not to get bogged down in discussing why it doesn't quite work, but just as Streisand doesn't always take direction well, ironically, she's directed in Hello, Dolly by another actor who was known to direct himself, Gene Kelly, and it's a kind of interesting film in terms of the talent attached to it, including, you know, Louis Armstrong and Walter Matthau, Michael Crawford, a lot of big names attached to it. But anyway, I don't want to get bogged down as to why it doesn't entirely work. But the fact that she is working, in other words, she's making a lot of big box office hits in the years ahead. And I'll just very quickly mention titles leading up to The Way We Were. On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever, The Owl and the Pussycat, Up the Sandbox. What's Up, Doc? Let me pause on that for just a moment. When she works with Peter Bogdanovich and Ryan O'Neal as the actor in that film, she has done some really serious films and she's done some really silly stuff. And she likes to be goofy sometimes. And in What's Up, Doc, they are overtly revisiting the screwball comedy format of the 1930s. And she's had some other films where she really just goes ditzy, silly, having fun that way. And that film worked critically and commercially. Right after that, actually, Marie, that was 1972. The Way We Were is 1973. That's actually one of my strongest early memories, Streisand. I mean, lasting memories. And the reason is exactly what Marie identified. It's such an overtly, shamelessly romantic film. It just oozes romance there. It doesn't try to gussy it up with high art or whatever. It's just, and also when I talk about cultural identity, you know, the Jewish performer, this is one of the movies where it's overtly there. She is playing a Jewish political radical in 1930s setting, and she meets up with a waspish character played by Hubert Robert Redford, right? So it's really a meeting of sorts between Jewish culture and WASP culture. And that's right there in the script. I mean, when they have a romantic relationship, like, well, what's she wearing? What's he wearing? How does he talk? What's she saying? You know what I'm saying? It's all there in the detail of it. And as to, you know, if there are bumps on the road of romance, some of those are, well, her background's very different from his. But these are issues always faced when you're from a distinct ethnic group and you're in a culture that is assimilation-minded. How does it affect your personal love life, that romantic life? But back to your point, Marie, is just simply that even though that's all in the script, it's all in The Way We Were, what you remember from the film is the star casting, you know, Barbara Streisand, Robert Redford on the screen together, the lush music, just the oozing sentimentality. It's unabashed, right? And I've had many friends who told me that seeing that film when it first came out or even years later on TV, and just kind of swooning over it. And it's been like a career-long swoon. So that's certainly one of her most famous films, one of her most notable films. And it gets her really into those decades. In the 1970s, 1980s, she is really working. I mean, we can single out whatever films you want to, but she's making a lot of films in this period.
Well, I did want to single out 1976 is A Star is Born, which is, of course, a remake of a remake. And she plays opposite Kris Kristofferson in this version. But some other really interesting choices were in the works before he got that part. So she wanted Elvis. They thought about Kenny Loggins and Mick Jagger. And the whole version was actually originally conceived as a vehicle for Carly Simon and James Taylor. So yeah, you can sort of remake it in your mind with all kinds of different characters. Apparently, she was very difficult to work with on this movie as well. And Kris Kristofferson said that, you know, it cured him of the movies, that it was worse than going through Ranger School. But it was a good vehicle to showcase her singing. And one thing that struck me when I was rewatching that the other day was how much influence she has over Sarah Jessica Parker's character on Sex and the City. And also Lady Gaga's presentation of the same movie later of A Star is Born. It owes so much to that whole Fanny Bryce, I'm a nice Jewish girl and I've got this big nose and it's holding me back. But really, you know, if you got to know me, you would love me. So she kind of mines that a little bit in A Star is Born. But before we run out of too much time, I want to make sure we spend enough time talking about her directing career with both The Prince of Tides and also Yentl. So let's start with The Prince of Tides, Mike. This is based on a Pat Conroy book that I absolutely loved. And I guess she did too, because she decided to take this on as a project that she would both direct and act in. And it was very well received, won a lot of awards, got her a lot of recognition, but, you know, kind of like, well, we'll, you know, we'll nominate your movie, but you're not going to be nominated for the big award. Say something about that, Mike, the refusal to really recognize her in what we can see as really excellent work.
Well, it's a curious question in the sense that it's difficult to answer it in a short form. In other words, for some reason, she's so famous and gets so much recognition and so on. But when it comes to Academy Awards, you know, for instance, the way we were, you know, films like that, you know, she's so popular with the public, and yet the Motion Picture Academy will give her all these nominations and give her some awards. Like in Star is Born, she did win an Academy Award for the song Evergreen. The picture otherwise is not a good film, but you know, didn't deserve Oscars. And when you mentioned the actors who were considered for the roles, it was kind of a rock music update of a venerable showbiz story. And it didn't quite work in terms of what the sudsy material is really all about in a contemporary rock setting. So there's some films like that where you can see why she wouldn't get, you know, Oscar recognition. But to your immediate question, when you look at Prince of Tides or Mirror Has Two Faces, Yentl, whatever, films where she's directing herself, for some reason, the film, you know, might have a mostly good critical reception, do well at the box office, and it might get some Oscar recognition. But for some reason, she's either not nominated or generally not even nominated as director. And I can point that out and share that observation with you, but how to fully explain that. And it may partly be that just simply that just as directors like William Wyler said, she's a lot to deal with, she's a lot to work with. Maybe people in Hollywood have kind of a mixed feeling that way too. Like, well, she, you know, she's really, you know, kind of full of herself, or, you know, do we need to give her another award or something? So I don't know exactly what's percolating there, but it might be along those lines. And I felt that way as a critic writing about the films we're mentioning right now. When The Mirror Has Two Faces came out in 1996, which she also directed, it's one of those, you know, multi-hyphenate films where she's doing this and she's doing that, you know, in terms of the whole film. And it gets to be a bit much, right? And when the camera's always going to close-ups of her, it's like, well, she's the director and here's another close-up of her. So I, speaking of mean things that people have said, I've been guilty of saying a few of them too. And when I was reviewing The Mirror Has Two Faces in 1996, I actually wrote this, quote, there ought to be limits to how much self-regard she should be allowed to express in any one movie. And, you know, I think in that later phase of the career, do you think, Marie, there might be something to that? People just think there's a lot to deal with here and just, you know, she's everywhere. Yes, it's talent, but it can almost seem overbearing at times. Do you know what I'm getting at?
I do. And I think that, yeah, but I think that there have been male directors who have been just as insufferable and have certainly been recognized. I mean, when you have somebody like Steven Spielberg tell Barbara Streisand that, you know, I'd really like to, you know, find something to tell you about your film that's a flaw, but I can't because it's perfect. He says it's the best directorial debut since Citizen Kane. I mean, if you're going to compare it with Citizen Kane, there's something is missing in terms of recognition. And I think it's what you might be alluding to, that, you know, not wanting her to get, you know, the big hit. But let's make sure we talk about Yentl before we run out of time, because it's such an incredible and interesting movie about a Jewish girl who has to disguise herself as a boy to get religious training. But it's not just about religious training, it's about books and about education and finding a way into the secret world of men and knowledge. And of course, she sings and she acts. And by the way, she likes to be photographed on the left side of her face more than the right, because she thinks the right is more masculine looking. But also another thing to look for in all of her movies is she always shows her fingernails. It's one of the hallmarks of her movies. So Mike, give us a rundown with our last 5 minutes on Yentl.
Okay, Yentl is based on an Isaac Bashevis Singer short story, and it takes place around 1904. Very much old world culture here. And this is a case there where there are issues of religion, but religion as it relates to gender and what's considered equitable or right, appropriate, if you will. So, you know, she wants to study the Talmud, but as a woman, she really would not be allowed to that way in terms of formal scholarship. And so she's going to disguise herself as a youth, as a young boy, a young man. And really a compelling story, doubling back also on why Streisand wanted to do this and how she went about doing it. She is the director of this film, Yentl. She's the producer. She co-scripted it. She did the songs. It's one of those, when we talk about multi-hyphenate talent, boy, Yentl's like off the charts. And even though, Maria, you and I have been talking back and forth about why hasn't she gotten full recognition from the Academy Awards as a director and this and that, Yentl did get a lot of recognition. I mean, critically, it was well-received. Commercially, it did well. And I think in her career, it's one of the most notable films because it's one of the films in which her identity, her cultural identity, as in Funny Girl, right? It's so front and center. It's right there. It's Barbra Streisand. And yeah, it's true. Other people could find her difficult to work with, but you know, imagine, you know, this is her world. This is the what she's bringing to the screen. And it's going to be exactly what she wants. She's painstaking. She's a perfectionist that way. And you know, to work with her is probably not always easy that way. And it may, and I can't fully explain this again. I know I keep doubling back on it, why the Academy Awards have, and you're right, they've essentially slighted her. They haven't really like as a best director, why didn't she get it for this or for that? But I think there might be some of that, just like, you know, how much more of the world does she want kind of thing? You know, I mean, you know what I'm getting at? It's just like, they're like, you know, she's doing all these things and if she's not easy to work with, some of the people who are voting for the Academy Awards are people she's worked with, right? And they might not want to throw the vote that way. I mean, if you had a bad experience on the set, are you going to vote for her as best director? And I'm speculating here, but do you think there might be something to that?
I think there definitely might be something to that. I think you're onto something. Barbra Streisand has said that the finest actor who ever lived, in her opinion, was Marlon Brando, that he was her idol when she was 13 and had done enough work to last two lifetimes. So she said, "Everything I do, I think, can Brando play this with me?" And that takes us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.